Well, thanks for having a chat with me. Slipstream's a film that I've long loved and been fascinated with, and it's been a bit of an odyssey to try and get someone to go on the record. But I figure, who better, being a screenwriter myself, who better than the writer to tell the tale?
Well, I have to say it was interesting. All the projects I've been involved with, it had a weird genesis because it had been a story by a guy named Bill Bauer originally, who I rewrote. He passed away years ago, but he did all the Wild Wild West shows with Ross Martin and Bob Conrad.
Right.
I had the fear of doing the last one, the last two-hour one,
right,
that he actually had written, and somehow I got full credit, which I didn't deserve. I was brought in to make it work because of budget reasons, and we originally had Paul Williams. We ended up with Jonathan Winters. But anyway, Bill was the original writer on Slipstream Story. He was a story writer.
Right.
And then Chuck Pope came along, who I knew, and Chuck's a great guy. He'd done The Fly, like Psycho. But he had a story, and they gave me the script, and I said, don't read it. I read it anyway, and it was kind of like almost a mini Star Wars. I mean, it had a droid in it. Okay, it didn't make, it wasn't really, I didn't know what it was. It was kind of a generic rip-off of a lower budget version of Star Wars.
Right.
And they brought me and, asked me, what do you think this should be? And I just came up with an idea, and that's how we ended up with the germ of what I started. It didn't end up with the film, but if you want to know what that was, I can tell you in about two sentences what my original concept was for Slipstream.
Right. Before we get into the meat of your adventures in the Slipstream, so to speak, for the audience that don't know, that are listening,
yeah.
Could you give us like a brief like your journey into your career, like a little bit of your origins, like how you began in screenwriting?
Yeah. Okay. I right out of college, I wrote a script that Bob Altman looked at. He didn't buy, but he told me he loved it. It was about set in the 50s. It was kind of like a Chinatown story with a blacklisting and twin girls and up in Topanga Canyon where I lived. And he thought it was brilliant. I got an agency, Adams Ray Rosenberg, to represent me. But then they threw me right into television because that's where all the money was.
Right.
And I started out, did a Waltons with a kid that I went to college with right out of college. And we ended up getting two or three more of those. And then I got into cop dramas, like Streets of San Francisco, and I was the executive consultant on a show called Beretta, but I didn't want to do television. I wanted to write features, and I wrote a little thriller called Out of Bounds, which Anthony Michael Hall, who was coming off a John Hughes rush of a lot of John Hughes hits, wanted to do something like Young Dirty Harry, so he picked my movie, and it threw me into the feature world, and I'd actually written a Dirty Harry for Quint. I got hired by Warners, but Clint decided it was going to be right after The Enforcer. It was going to be called The Avenger. He didn't want to do any more Dirty Harry. So
right.
I got paid to do the script that never came to fruition. I even drove up to Carmel to meet Clint to beg him, but he wasn't there. And everyone told me it was the best one since the original. But that's how I got into the feature world,
wow,
writing this Dirty Harry script. And then Out of Bounds was my first feature, which was a big bomb. And I got along with Michael very well, Anthony Michael Hall, but he was going through a phase as a young kid, and, he wanted to be not looked at as a nerd, and he thought he was young James Dean at the time, and he kind of mumbled his way through the whole picture, and the thing turned out a mess. We had Richard Tuggle directing it, who did Tightrope and Escape from Alcatraz, but Richard had only directed one film, and, it was kind of hard for him. He needed help, and we had Bruce Surtees as the DP, so he was a big help.
Yeah.
And Richard quit the movie at one point. I was asked to shoot the rest.
Wow.
Came back on. So I directed Flowers in the Attic. I reshot that movie. It was already made. It wasn't releasable. It didn't have an ending. I mean, it either got made, but they were great pictures. Ron and Brian loved this film, Fire. I rewrote the guy who wrote Gladiator and Amistad.
Right,
he was
right.
A great writer. He was going through some personal problems at the time, and I was brought in, and Ron loved my take, and it was about like two kids on an island, a bunch of mercenaries, kind of like Stand By Me. It was an interesting film. We never got it going because Ron had three commitments. He had to direct. He just formed Imagine Pictures. He wasn't available, and Warners would not put the film into turnaround once they formed Imagine. So it sat there for years. A couple other people approached me It was in my script. They wanted to make it. I said, I don't own it. Warner's doesn't. It's just language there. Right. But it was one of my better projects. I really loved it. And I worked with Ron and Brian on two movies, and both of them got stuck at the studios, and they moved on, and that was it. That's Hollywood. You gotta just throw everything in the air and go for the next one.
Totally. So you've obviously always loved the movies. Always been your ambition.
Yeah, I've always loved really good stories. I love adventures. I like dark. I was kind of more kind of a noirish kind of guy. I loved Chinatown. I loved the James Ellroy piece. Russell Crowe, where he played.
L.A. Confidential.
Yeah, I loved that. It was one of my favorites. Yeah. And I was so frustrated because people would say to me, I didn't get it. I said, what do you mean you didn't get it? They explained the whole thing at the end in case you didn't get everything. And they said, well, what was this about? I said, no. It was just about corruption in the police department and how horrible it was. But they got lost in all the subplots. And that's what was sad to me, because today people's attention span is so short. Everything has to be visual. They got to see it. They don't really want too complicated a story. And Slipstream, unfortunately, was very complicated when I was brought in. It was like three different movies.
Yeah.
I was trying to sort out what was this film really trying to say.
Yeah.
But I'd done a lot of thrillers, and I just recently won the Madrid International Film Festival a year ago for a spec script I did called Rivers of Babylon about young kids going up on the streets of Kingston, Jamaica, that are given guns by the politicians, asked to go into the ghettos to protect them, and then promised jobs. And as soon as the elections are over, of course, there's no jobs. Kids turn to petty crime. The same guys that hired him turn the army and the cops against them. They flee to America in the mid-80s and become the most ferocious posse ever to hit U.S. shores. That movie won the Madrid International Film Festival last year for Best Unproduced Screenplay.
Oh, well done.
It was a finalist in the Tenerife Film Festival, Berlin. We're hoping to get it made. I had 50 Cent involved for maybe 3 seconds about 4 months ago. Both Andre Barkowiak and Andre Sekula, two top VPs, want to direct it, but they're 65-year-old Polish guys, and looking for a young Jamaican kind of guy with music chops that could be African-American, anything that you can really see this. I mean, they would be great cinematographers. And Barkowiak loved it because he had dated a Jamaican woman.
Yeah.
And he really wanted to do it.
I
told him the story. He said, no, not Barkowiak, too slow, too expensive, let me do it. I gave him the script, he loved it.
Yeah.
We've gotten round and around, we haven't gotten it set up yet.
He just directed another movie, what's his name, Barkowiak?
Yeah, he did. He said a couple, the problem was he was supposed to do Rivers, and he took Doom, which was his downfall. It was that big computer game.
Oh, yeah.
Cost $70 million.
Dwayne Johnson movie.
So he started doing other things. He worked on a Russian picture, and he's worked on some odd jobs. But this guy's direct. I mean, this guy's DP'd everything from Christie's Honor to Falling Down to Terms of Endearment to The Verdict.
Yeah. Maybe you need to get The Rock involved.
Oh, I know. That's true. He's in everything. Yeah. It's interesting how things come and go. I have another script. I just got optioned that Courtney Love was attached to star. Then she fell out. Halle Berry was on board. The company was a British film called IAC that was doing Cromwell in England. They went bankrupt, so the whole movie reverted back to me. The script never got made. Hilary Shore, who produced The Butler, and I forget what the most recent, she did another film, but she was going to be the producer. And now I've got a distribution company trying to set it up. We're looking to get Rooney Mara, but we don't have the money, so who knows how that'll end up. But it's an FBI agent in New Orleans, serial killer, very interesting psychological twist, a lot of twisty stuff in it. It's very different than most serial killer stories.
Right. So, getting back to Slipstream, let's start with where we left off. What was your two sentence take on the whole thing?
Well, my take was, I said, how about a movie? Because they had two lead characters. They have a guy who picks up a prisoner and is going to take him upriver for a bounty.
Right.
And I said, this reminds me a little of The Last Detail, the Jack Nicholson
movie. Yeah, yeah.
And along the way, all the things that happened to Jack Nicholson and the prisoner and the guys, I said, but what our hero doesn't know, or our anti-hero, which is Bill Paxton, plays the part of Matt Owens, he's kind of given up on life because of the apocalypse and what's happened, and but he doesn't realize the guy he picked up is not a human, it's an android.
Right.
And this android gives him hope, gives him like that the world isn't doomed and there is hope. And in return, Matt gives the android, teaches him about human emotion and love. And that's what the movie becomes. These two guys kind of bonding along the way, and they're being pursued by Mark Hamill, the bounty hunter, Trasker.
Right.
And along the way, they meet a whole bunch of, you know, crazy people. Like, Ben Kingsley fell into the movie by accident. I had met him at Pinewood while I was writing, doing the rewrite. And I was sitting alone in the studio, and it was packed. I mean, I wasn't alone. The commissary was so crowded, there was no place. And there was one chair in front of me at a little table, and he walked up and said, "Do you mind if I join you?" I said, "No, please, please, Gandhi." You know, sitting down there talking.
Wow.
And it was great, and he asked me what I was doing. And then when I got back to L.A. about 3 months later, 4 months later, my agent said, "Guess what? Ben Kingsley asked if he could be in your movie." And I said, "Wow, that's just terrific." So, and he played the avatar, and that was all based on, I had seen an article in a magazine of a cult that worshiped the wind, and they strapped themselves to these 70-foot kites in Japan and floated them up in the air, and I thought, wow, that's kind of wild, so let's make that picture.
Yeah, put that in, yeah.
Yeah, that was in there. Now, the F. Murray Abraham character was already in the original script, the Cornelius character,
yeah.
And he was kind of the last vestige of civilization hanging onto a library, the only books that were left that man had, but he didn't, the story, it never kind of gelled for me, that segment, the last, about what he was doing or why he was there or what they were trying to do. We tried to work everything in, and meanwhile, I was focusing on more of the Mark Hamill bounty hunter chasing, you know, Matt and Byron, Bob Peck, through the slipstream. So, and there was supposed to be a big air war at the end, but they didn't have enough money for that.
Right.
They did have some great people. You know, they had some great people on the film. A lot of, they had the stunt, I mean, the guy who did all the James Bond stuff, and they had a great production designer from England. I'm like blank on some of that.
That's right.
Stuff. And they had Elmer Bernstein doing the music, and yeah. Frank Tidy, the cameraman. So it had some great production stuff. They shot a lot of it in Turkey. Those cliffs and those things were all done in Turkey, and a lot of the air stuff. And they used gliders and balloons. And actually, Fergie came up to me after the premiere with Andrew and said they loved it because they loved to fly. And I was real pissed at the producers because they didn't want to pay Bill Paxton's way. Kind of had a falling out. I had a falling out with all of them. And they said, "Well, what did she say to you? What did she say to you?" I said, "Well, she just said that Andrew was going to be away on the weekend. Did I want to come by the Royal Palace?" And that's all I told them. But
wow.
But the film was, you know, it came out the same time the Tom Cruise movie came out. I forget which one it was, and it kind of killed us. We had a royal premiere in London.
Wow.
And, we never got it. Jerry Weintraub wanted to distribute it, but the Greens, these distributors in England, Nigel and Trevor, didn't like the deal, and we never got an American distribution deal. And
wow.
It was sad because it ended up playing all over Europe, you know, but never got into American theaters. And Jerry was all gung-ho, but they didn't want to make the deal with him. And there were two guys named William Brownstein and Arthur Meslansky who were the original producers. And this is what was so weird about the whole project, which I was telling you, is the money was already set. They were making a film come hell or high water. It didn't matter whether they had a script or anything. They were making the movie. There was money put aside. I don't know if it was $13 million, working or whatever it was, to make this film, and that and it was going to happen. And I hadn't even written it yet.
Okay.
And so I was told, like, you know, be in London for a month, and I ended up there 4 months.
Wow.
It was back and forth. Steve Lisberger was the director. He had just had a child recently. He was all into the stuff about kids, and some of his ideas didn't mesh with mine. And then I'd be taken out to dinner by Brownstein and Meslansky saying, "You know, put some more action, violence. Let's get that." Gary Kurtz, who was one of the producers of Star Wars and Dark Crystal, he's a Quaker. He didn't want violence. His wife wanted more sex. This real sexy woman. I'd go to his house in Richmond. Relationship in it. You know,
oh, my goodness.
No, we don't want that. It
was
like everybody was pulling at me. And I remember the last week I blew up, and they were all at the studio, and I said, "Look, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to step out of this office for half an hour. I want all you guys to decide on what you want. What is this movie going to be? Because every time I have dinner with somebody, I get a different take. You want this, he wants that, don't do this. And I want to hear it from him." We never came up with one cogent, you know, a straight story, you know, like what everybody thought it should be.
Right.
And in the end, it was actually, they cut a lot of my stuff out, and we ended up with an 89-page script, and then I got a call from Whisper, I got to come and do a narration because it was too short. We got to put stuff over it to explain what's going on, and it was kind of just all slapped together, you know, and it came out within like a year after we finished it, so it really was an amazing, how they got it together and got everybody on board, and you know, they even had Robbie Coltrane, who I love, in the movie, and the stage actress, Kitty Aldrich, and she was in A Room with a View. She was great. But it was sad because it could have been a lot more, I thought. I mean, there were great things in it, and I just think everybody was so harried because it was coming together so quickly, and, you know, it was one of those things that was more important, is just getting it made.
Yeah.
Really, you know, having time to...
So these two producers, they greenlit it based on this Bill Bowers story, or...
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they hired yourself to come and to...
Bill Bauer wrote the original story, which I never saw the original concept. Why don't they? They said, no, you don't need to see that. And then I saw the Chuck Pogue script that was like, it's more like kind of a mini Star Wars with a droid and something. The android is like a little robot thing. And then, you know, I just didn't... I said, well, it's too similar. And they said, no, we agree. What do you want to do? So when I told them my take, they liked it. They said, yeah, we like that. The last detail, kind of, the guy takes the guy up river, and they, you know, they get something from each other. You know, like I said, the one guy, the android helps the guy learn about humanity and how it's not the end, and there's a chance, and you can, and because all Paxton was in it for was the money. He was like a scrounger. I kind of saw him as a young Harrison Ford guy who was just real cynical and didn't give a damn and just wanted to get his bounty, and you know, and then I loved Bob Peck. He's such a great actor. He had a lot going, and he, you know, Paxton teaches him about human emotions, what love is, and tears and things that he never experienced because he's an android.
Yeah,
and he thought that would be interesting, and then also Mark Hamill was great. You know, he played a different role. I mean, you know, the spiked white platinum-haired bounty hunter, he was like Billy Idol on steroids.
Yeah, yeah. But one of the internet rumors that came out of it, this is the film that sent Gary Kurtz bankrupt, and hence the film is public domain now.
Yeah, it was a, I don't know, a company called Moonstone picked it up, and they, I don't know what they did with it. They might have distributed it in Europe and stuff, because I did a movie for Moonstone with Marley Matlin. It's an Israeli couple, and it was a nightmare working with them. They tried to screw me over the money and everything, but I read that they had the film, so I called the Writers Guild. I said, well, it's showing at some sales thing, big thing. They own it now, and it turned out they owed me like $50,000 that they never paid me because they bought it. The Guild got involved, got me my money for that, but I never knew what happened to it. I don't see Moonstone's name anymore. I don't know how many people it went through, and Gary was living off in Richmond, and he was living off the success of Star Wars and Dark Crystal and stuff, and I think he had plenty of money, but this was, I don't know how much of his money was actually involved in this, because those guys, Brownstein and Lansky, came aboard, and they had something to do with the financing, and the Greens were European, British guys that distributed a lot of stuff in Europe, and Nigel and Trevor, and they just were so, I think Gary Kurtz would have been fine if they would have let Weintraub distributed here in the States. It might have made some money, but it never got a shot. And can't make money.
The other legend, or the internet rumor, or what went around, was that in a Gary Kurtz interview, he said, you know, like you mentioned, that the script had many scenes of violence, and they were in the script but were never filmed, and that added to the sort of incoherent nature of the movie.
That's what it was. There were things that weren't filmed, there were things that were taken out, and I was just frustrated because I could tell Gary wasn't happy with what I wanted to do with it, my take on it, how it should have been more of a pursuit story about the bounty hunter going after two guys, and then the two guys were the focus and their relationship, and then all that other stuff from the other scripts got thrown in, and you know, and then we added the Avatar character. I mean, there was just so many different things that never gelled for me, is what was the movie really supposed to be about now? I mean, they wanted to leave things in from the prior film that, like I say, I didn't know what to do with them. You know, they were just kind of, and Lisberger I don't know. He was going through. Like, I remember one time there was a line in the script, and the actor asked me, Bob Peck, somebody says, "Old King Cole is a merry old soul." He goes, "What does that mean?" And they asked me, and I said, "You know what? Lisberger was reading that rhyme to his little kid, and he loved it, and he wanted that in there. I don't know what it has to do with your character, whoever. But he just wanted me to put it in there, and we had a big fight about it. I said, it makes no sense. I mean, it's just babble, psychobabble. I mean, why is he saying it? But these are the type of things I was kind of up against, and it was like, you know, he was the director. I had to do what he wanted, so I tried. And I was very frustrated. I was trying to please everybody, and nobody could agree on, you know, what they wanted. And that was the hardest part for me. I've never worked on a film like that where there's so many divergent, you know, everybody going off on their own takes as to what it really was. You know, and I know I got panned really bad in England when it came out, the premiere, and you know, and the writer always gets blamed for most of that. So,
all of the stuff that Bob says he quotes poetry and stuff, is that all from your original script?
No, a lot of that was just thrown in. I didn't have any of the, you know, that type of stuff. A lot of that was there, or it was put into it. But like I say, Steve just, you know, he was fascinated. His young child. I mean, we went out to a restaurant in London, and in England, they don't like when you bring very young children to restaurants. And my girlfriend at the time scared the kid. He started shrieking, crying, and everybody in the restaurant was furious.
Right.
Wanted us to leave. You know, and Steve was so into his kid, and that was part of the story. He wanted some kind of element, but it didn't really jive with the characters at that point in the story. So
right.
I tried to, you know. And,
so you think he saw it as more of a family film? That was his angle.
Yeah, I think he might have seen it more that way, and I think Gary saw it more, Gary Kurtz more as a, I think as a societal thing about what would happen to society if, you know, everything was lost. And, you know, like I said, that's why F. Murray Abraham ran he had his own world. He didn't want anybody to come into it because this was all the only vestige left of humanity was the book and the library and all those things.
Well, that certainly does explain the clunky nature. I mean, look, I've always loved it. I'm never going to say I don't love it, and I watch it. I still watch it a fair bit. But I mean, that what you're saying really does explain the disjoint. There is a disjointed nature when you watch it, like, you know.
They were taking bits from other movie, you know, the other script, and putting it into my story, and then trying to make my story jive with. And I had rewrote, the whole beginning was changed. I mean, they even had like a Star Wars bar in it with weird characters, you know? That's not going to work in this, you know? It's not an outer space movie, you know? So, but I saw it more, you know, it's like there was a Viggo Mortensen film about an apocalypse not so long ago. And I saw it kind of like that. I saw that here's this world and, you know, there was a, you know, it says in the beginning there was all a nuclear thing and people lived along the slipstream and they were trying to rebuild their lives. And then here's a guy who comes along and just sells anything he can find. He's a scrounger and he's told, you know, he overhears that somebody's going to take this guy up river to collect the reward. And that's all he cares about is getting the reward. And it changes his whole life and the way he looks at things, this guy, this android. And he changes the android. And then I wanted an action piece. You know, I wanted the Vamil. He's such a good villain that there'd be a big air battle at the end. There'd be a thing in the slipstream, but we couldn't do it, you know, visually. It was too expensive, and I don't know, you know. So they had to cut that down, and then I kind of was back in L.A., and I never knew what happened to it until they wanted a voiceover kind of narration to fill in all the stuff they'd cut out.
Yeah, you can always, I don't know if it's just me, but I could always tell when there's something, you know, always when there's that little narration at the start, well, okay, this is the bit of the story we couldn't afford to make, folks.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, and it happened too on that John McTiernan movie, The 13th Warrior. Like, they had a lot of trouble at the start of that, I heard. So that's why Banderas came in and it did some narration, and there's some quick montage over the front because there was the start of the film was supposed to be more expansive than it was.
Yeah, well, that's how this was. I don't think they just didn't have enough money. Like I say, these other guys they brought in were putting up, they were kind of funding the gap money that they needed to get the movie made. Mm. And they had to have it done. I don't know if the loan came due on a certain day or something, but they had to get it done. Everything was rushed, you know. It was like, because I was originally told I was going to only be there for 3 weeks, and I should have known the whole thing was kind of ill-fated because I landed during the hurricane.
Okay.
London hadn't had a hurricane since 1700. I landed there in October of 87, and it was one of the worst hurricanes they had. They had 140-mile-hour winds that took up giant trees in Hyde Park and
wow.
uprooted them, and I mean, we overshot the runway, and it kind of was like a sign of something to come.
Wow. You literally landed in the slipstream.
Yeah, we landed in the slipstream. That's yeah. true. It was different, you know. And plus, I was going through a thing. I brought this woman with me who I was fighting with constantly. I shouldn't have brought her. And, you know, we just had interesting experiences, like, when the premiere came, they put me at the front of the line. Why, I don't know, because a friend of mine was looking at the film for maybe picking it up in distribution, a guy named Bobby Rock. He worked for a company that was kind of interested in it. And we went out and had a bunch of martinis. So I was totally bombed. And they put me at the front of the line. And they said, now, you know, when you meet Lady Sarah, you bow and she curtsies and you don't say anything. You just call them your Royal Highnesses. Let them ask you the questions. And she came up to me. I was the first one. She goes, so, Tony, how did you come up with such a wild idea? And I looked at her. I said, gee, Fergie, I just have a bizarre mind. And everybody went white. All the British people like froze because I didn't call her your Royal Highness. I called her She started giggling. She loved it.
That's beautiful.
And I'm so sorry, your Royal Highness. You know. And I said after the movie, she came up and told me that they loved it because they liked the fly. She and Andrew loved, you know, flight stuff in and all that. It was a trip, you know.
That's great. That's the martinis
yeah,
talking.
You know, and the British premiere is so different because it was a black tie thing, and I'm walking in, and everybody's waving at us, and I'm thinking, they don't know who I am, but I'm waving back.
You yeah,
know,
yeah.
The writers in Hollywood, nobody knows who the writer is. I mean, all these people, look at this, it's great. It was a real big to-do, but like I say, Tom Cruise was playing at another theater right across the way, whatever movie he had out at the time,
yeah.
And it might have been that one about the Vietnam vet on COVID.
Oh, yeah, Born on the 4th of July, yeah.
Was premiering at about the same time, so we got Fergie, and we didn't get Lady Diana, you know,
okay.
We didn't get her, because she was there. Yeah,
so we went to see that one.
They didn't want Bill Paxton originally.
They didn't want him? Okay. Who were they?
No, I had done, I had met Michael Hall at Weird Science.
Right.
He was going to star in my movie Out of Bounds, and Bill was a good friend of his. And we hung out at the Chateau Marmont up here on Sunset. I lived right across the street, and I really loved Bill. I liked his attitude, and I said to the producer, God, you got to, let's hire, because they didn't have the money to get any, you know, like an Harrison Ford type act. I said, go for Bill Paxton. He's going to be like the next Harrison Ford. He's kind of got that, you know, he's an everyman. He's kind of really cool. He's a laconic kind of guy, but he's interesting. And I think he'd be good for this. So I really fought for him, and they got him. You know, they found
him.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, they liked him.
Yeah.
Put him in the film.
And like you said, Ben Kingsley was a complete accident.
Ben Kingsley we hit it off so well because I had told him, I was so amazed at how he just came up and asked if he could sit and talk to me. I said, you know, in Hollywood, if I'm doing a movie and I'm over at Warner Brothers and there's Bruce Willis, I couldn't walk up to him. He's got 10 bodyguards protecting him. You can't get near him. I said, he just came up to me, sat down, we started talking. And I had said, you know, what are you doing? He said, I'm doing a movie with Michael Caine. And I said, geez, I love Michael. You know, the lady who cuts my hair cuts his hair and does Sean's toupee. And she told me if I ever saw him, say hello. He goes, he's right over there. I'll introduce you. So he takes me over to Michael Caine. And Michael says, we start talking, and I told him I love The Man Who Would Be King, one of my favorite movies.
Oh, yeah.
We all hit it off, and he just said, look, Tony, we're working stiffs. We're not like celebrities here in England. We all came from, you know, working class backgrounds, and we love the craft. I said, no, it shows. You guys are actors, you know. You're not celebrities. That's what I love about England. And,
yeah.
And Ben was so great. And I saw Ben in Sexy Beast later, and I thought, wow, what an actor this guy is, from Gandhi to Sexy Beast.
That's a great...
He liked the idea, and he liked me, I guess, and
called
his agent and said, you know, this guy told me about a film, I'd like to be in it, so it was great that we got him. I was like,
for such a small part,
it was a small part, and at one point, he didn't even take a credit. When
it
was first credited, I didn't see his name, but he just wanted to do it. I mean, you know, we hit it off. Like I when I was younger and I wanted to be a screenwriter, I was involved in a movie called Foxtrot. A friend of mine was a unit production manager. It was with Peter O'Toole and Charlotte Rampling shooting in Cabo. It's a Roger Corman film, and I ended up driving Charlotte's dressing room down to Cabo, a big motorhome, because I wanted to meet her. I had a script I wanted to give her, and I played poker with O'Toole and beat him every night and was told that I better let him win or he's going to be a nightmare on the film. So
that's fantastic. I love Peter O'Toole, man. You sat and got drunk with him? That's great.
Yeah. And when we were doing that film, he had his pancreas removed. He could no longer drink, but he was doing a lot of coke.
Okay.
And he was a character, though, and he was so out there. I mean, he would talk to me end on end. We sit and talk, and it went way over my head most of what he's saying. He was a brilliant guy. I just was like amazed by him. And he was very athletic, which you look at the guy and you wouldn't think so. He looked so frail, but he was throwing a football around, but they had to have like an umbrella over him because Baja was like 116 degrees where we were shooting. He's so white and thin.
That's
but
fantastic.
He was a heck of an athlete. And I said, wow, you know, I never thought he'd, but that was an interesting experience. But I love the Brits because, and Charlotte and I became friends with her. I loved her. I took her out to dinner one night. She was married to a rugby player. It turned out he was gay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was...
You're the right man at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, and I told her, she said, when I met her, I said, I hope you don't... why did you want to see me so bad? Because my friend Igor said, Tony came all the way from L.A. just to meet you. I said, well, I saw you in the Night Porter. She goes, oh, I hope you don't think I'm that decadent. I said, oh, I was kind of hoping. She goes, this is my husband, Brian. Here's this big, huge rugby guy. Hey, Brian, how are you? But, you know, it was interesting meeting her. She was really cool.
That's fantastic. Like you said, another small part, it was a relatively small part in the film, was Murray Abraham. I'm surprised he...
he was in the original script. He was Gilliam's character with the library, and it was so small that I didn't even think the movie needed it anymore because it wasn't about the initial thing about the civilization now. And see, if that was what it was about, I thought Murray Abraham should have been a much bigger part in the whole film. He's trying to save the vestige of what was left of mankind before the apocalypse, the books and any written history and everything. But it was so small that it didn't really fit. It was just like a stop on the way as they were being pursued. And, you know, I didn't really understand what the whole point of that was at that point. I just said,
and did you get to did you get to meet him off camera or
no? I didn't get to meet him, and I always loved him because he played a dirty cop in Serpico, and I write dark cop movies. He played a narc, he was also in Scarface too. And I loved him. He's such a good character.
He gets thrown out of the helicopter.
when he got thrown out, that was great. No, I didn't meet him. He came. I think after I left, they shot his scenes. I don't even know. They were all interior things, so they might have shot him in London.
You primarily went to Pinewood. You didn't go to the turkey shoot or anything like that?
No, I didn't go to the turkey. No, I was in Pinewood the whole time. I had a whole house there. I was picked up every day, by Gary Kurtz's limo guy and taken out to Pinewood.
Had they shot all the turkey stuff when you came, or did they do that afterwards?
No, they hadn't. They were just starting that because they brought in that stunt guy for the James Bond thing.
Right.
Really good stunt coordinator. And they were shooting some of that. They were actually shooting some of the turkey stuff while I was writing the script.
Okay.
Because they had to get that done.
Mm.
And see, what I didn't understand was, what if the script, you hate it? You know, what are you going to do? I mean, you're going to keep rewriting. I mean, you're shooting stuff now. They're building the sets while I was writing. And I hadn't even turned in anything yet, and I thought, wow, this is strange. I've never been in a movie that it's being put together before there's even the script was finished. But that's why I think it all was such a mishmash, because everybody was in such a hurry to get something out there to get that tax break or get the money in the bank. And
was the whole thing that Matt wanted to get downstream to open a balloon shop, was that your idea?
No, that was part of that. You know, they had that in there.
Yeah.
There were things they wanted. They wanted to do the most fantastic flying stuff that they could come up with that wouldn't be motorized, like not real planes, but gliders, balloons, anything that could float along the slipstream that would look different.
Right.
Because, you know, because we said, so where would they get all the other stuff if the world had been destroyed and there's no more, you know, in industry or anything, you know, so they have, everyone's having to jimmy rig things to fly on. So that's where they came up with all these.
Right.
And we kept that.
That's kind of the end of the. Like, he brings it up briefly a couple of times, and then the end of the movie is, like, just shots of these very George Melies sort of balloons floating around.
That was Andrew McAlpine was the production designer. I think part of that was his vision. He was the production designer on the thing. I mean, we always wanted that. We wanted it to be this really visually different kind of film.
You had Frank, who had done The Duelists and...
He did The Duelist and Package with Gene Hackman, another good movie I like.
Yeah,
Under
Siege.
Duelist was beautiful to
look
at, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean...
He had a lot of good technical people on it. You know, and then you got Elmer Bernstein doing the music. You had Andrew McAlpine. He had some really good... now, I wish I could remember. I feel bad that the stunt guy was very famous. I want to say Roger Deakins. No, he's a cinematographer. But the stunt guy was a famous guy because he did a lot of the Bond films because he was out of Pinewood. He was a kind of a resident guy that did all this stuff. So he choreographed a lot of that stuff for us. But I was kind of just pulled up in a room.
A room and a typewriter, yeah.
That's another funny thing. Back then, I was using an IBM Selectric typewriter. I didn't have a computer then.
Right.
And they put me up in the Hilton. Over by I can't think of the area, but I was at that Hilton International Hotel, and they didn't have enough power in the hotel for me to use my electric typewriter. It blew out all the electricity.
Wow.
And I said, this is like a third world country. They had to bring in a generator into my room, which took up half my room. I couldn't even get around to the bed.
Oh, wow.
I used my typewriter. I was on Kensington High Street at the Hilton International there, and I remember, Great Britain, they can't run a typewriter in a hotel. I mean, but that's, so then they moved me out to the studio where they had more, where I could at least type out there. But I would just turn in pages, and then I'd get notes, and then, like I say, different people would take me to dinner and want different things, and finally, I remember at one point, Lisberger blew up at me, and he said, I don't want you listening to them. Listen to me, you know. But I wanted to say, well, but I don't know what your vision is. I
gotta
listen to everybody.
That's got to be like, you know, and I've been down that road myself. I mean, I've never had a script produced or anything, but you hear from so many different people, oh, I think this should happen, I think that should happen. And then you speak to another writer and say, oh, we'll just take the best ideas. And I said, well, but none of them are any good.
Right. That's it. I mean, that's sort of the writer's curse. It's like, and the only guy I've ever worked for where I really didn't have that experience was Ron Howard.
That
was incredible. And he would give me some ideas and throw them out and say, Tony, if this doesn't work, I don't even want you to call me and talk about it. Forget about it. It's up to you. You're the writer. I trust you. I love your stuff. Don't worry. And when I turned in my first draft of Fire, he loved it. He went crazy. And we couldn't, the directors of my agency tried to put on Michael Mann and Walter Hill were totally wrong for it. And we couldn't get it going. But it's sad. But he was a great guy to work for because he encouraged the writer and anything I came up with, he goes, I love this. I love, you know. But these guys, it was just more like they want this and you got to put it in there. And even if you tell them it didn't work, you got to put it in there somehow. And then it would get to the point where, you know, I said, yeah, but I have to make this into a cohesive story where we can follow what's going on. I was trying my best, you know.
So Gary Kurtz was a Quaker. I thought he just grew that beard because he was going for the whole Ahab thing.
No, he was he's a Quaker. I'm pretty sure that's what he was. And his wife, it was his second wife. He married his secretary, fiery redheaded woman who I really liked. She had us out to dinner at their house in Richmond, and she was the one who suggested, why don't you have a little relationship, a little more sexual, between Kitty Aldridge and Bill, or maybe the internet? I said, yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, we need something more about the humanity.
It's funny, I watched the film again last night, you know, preparing for, you know, our conversation, and it's funny now, thinking about it, and listening to what you've said, I can see where your story sort of permeates and then it where it deviates from that. So it's weird.
Because my story, I opened it, I changed the whole opening, and that I was going to go with that and keep going with my story and follow it through. And then I had to take these little detours that were in the original script, and, you know, and then, you know, along the way they meet Avatar, and along the way they meet Cornelius, and it just, you know, they were stops, but they didn't really move the story along to a point where, for me, it kind of was a diversion that slowed everything down all the time, instead of keeping that tension between the Mark Hamill chase, the pursuit, Paxton and Andrew, what they were, you know, trying to do. And it just seemed like it was, those other things were getting in the way, but they were in there and they had them and that's what they wanted. And, you know, I had to kind of make it work, but I never felt it did when I saw the final thing out. I said, you know, visually there's some good things and some of it I really like, but I, you know, a lot of it could have been so much better if we had the time or people would have sat down and said, let's think this through here.
Yeah.
Because I thought the ending could have been a lot better.
Because it just kind of ends. Like he kills Mark Hamill and then, you know, he climbs the mountain and he's off to go find, you know, that place he keeps referring to. And, you know, it doesn't.
That was kind of part of the director deal. He decided, you know, they wanted to wrap it up quicker and then do it. And like I said, then they ended up with a script that was way too short.
Yeah.
And it did, you know, it was like it could have been another 20 pages long at least, you know. And so that's when we had to add the narration. And, you know, it was just kind of a big mishmash. And I mean, everybody kind of afterwards kind of distanced themselves from any involvement. Even my agent got mad at me because I was trying to do this other movie for Jerry Weintraub, this boxing film, and all my time was wrapped up in Slipstream, and Jeremy Zimmer, who was a big Hollywood agent, was screaming at me, I told you shouldn't have taken that movie, you know, it's a waste of time. I said, yeah, but it got made. It was a film that at least was getting made, and I was getting paid, and, you know, and the other film I was doing had Kirk Douglas involved. It was a nightmare. Kirk was just impossible. I mean, he was an older guy. He wanted a sex scene. And I said, Kirk, no one wants to see you having sex at 80 years old. I mean, you know, please. Let's, you know,
that's fantastic. So you met Kirk Douglas or you talked to him?
I was in his house.
That's fantastic.
I said, what is this? I said, Kirk, you were gone for 12 weeks. I was in London writing Slipstream, okay?
Yeah.
And I was working on this movie, meeting with Jerry Weintraub's people and having phone conversations. And you were off doing your thing and Jeff Canoe, who's going to be the director, was off doing his thing. Then you come back to me a week before the writer's strike and say, no, we don't want to do this movie. Let's do the original, our original idea. I said, but Jerry Weintraub told us he didn't like our original idea and he wasn't going to make that movie. And he goes, yeah, but I'm the producer. And I said, no, Jerry's paying me. He's the producer. You know, we were doing kind of a remake of Champion, his famous film that he did, which is great. Right. With Arthur Kennedy. It was a great movie. And now he was an old guy who gets beat up by this kid coming out of the unemployment office, getting his check or his pension check. And he says, kid, you know, you got a lot going for you. You could be a champion. I could teach you. And the kid says, you know, fuck you. But then it turns out that he becomes his manager. And then all of a sudden the kid ditches him for like a Don King kind of guy. But in the end has to come back with his tail between his legs because he needs Kirk to help him win the championship fight.
Right.
But in the middle, Kirk wanted to sleep with the kid's girlfriend. And I said, no, Kirk. You're so unlikable at that point.
Yeah.
You don't care.
And plus,
you know?
you're
okay. Here's the thing.
Yeah.
I'm in the bedroom, and I don't. You don't see me sleep with her, but she comes out with a towel on, and he's sitting on the bed, and he just looks down at his crotch. And goes, who knew? And I said, no, Kirk. That still says that you slept with her. I'm not writing that scene. He got so mad at me, threw the script at me. And he said to me, are you only in this for the money? And I'm literally sitting in his house in Beverly Hills. He has an original Picasso, a Moreau, something else on the wall. These are original paintings worth millions of dollars. And I looked at him, I said, Kirk, how did you get all these things? And he got really red-faced at me. He said, what are you saying? I said, I'm telling you, I'm willing to rewrite this movie 10 times for you. But Jerry Weintraub's paying me. He's the producer. So you have to go back in, if you're producing it, and tell him, I want to do our original idea, Jerry. Let Tony take a pass at that, and then let's see where we go. But he couldn't, you know. It was just like, and then the ICM got pissed at me. The agency dropped me because they said I was not, you know, I just couldn't get along with people.
Wow.
I just got so, you know, so it was just one of those things. But
Tony, why haven't you written the book yet, my friend? Why haven't you written the, you know?
I should have written the book, and I've worked with a lot of crazy producers over the years, and
Because these are some great yarns. You need to write the tell all, my friend.
I know. There's a lot more. But Slipstream, like I say, was a unique story because rarely does a movie go into production before they even have a script, and that's what happened. I mean, it was literally the sets were being built, the Turkish scenes were being scouted and looked and starting to get shot, and everything was going. It was just turning ahead as I was turning in pages, you know, trying to keep up with everything else.
Was the hot tub scene your idea when they go in?
That was we talked about it. It was kind of a joint idea. We kind of wanted something like that. I told you Gary's wife wanted stuff in it, and we wanted something with Bill and then the Kitty and all, you know, we said we got to have some other stuff in here. And it was like a brothel, but they had a bedroom scene or something.
There was that big scene in Robbie Coltrane and all them were in this big hot tub or whatever it is.
Yeah, he was in the, yeah, no, that, that, they just put that in there. It was just, and I love Robbie. I mean, he's a character, he's a great actor.
Yeah. I like how he's playing with the little boats and stuff in it and like, you know.
That might have been Lisberger's. All right. I didn't write it. But that was in there, and I liked it, actually. I thought it was different. But there were so many different things in it that didn't quite, you know, they just were like, oh, well, that's interesting.
Why don't we do that?
Yeah, but it wasn't something that I put. Like I said, I was kind of focused on trying to do a straight drama with, two guys that come together and give each other something. And meanwhile, there's this hot pursuit with this bounty hunter on their tail, and, you know, and they've got to navigate through the slipstream, and I thought it would be really visual and interesting and a good action kind of piece, but with characters. And then, like I said, they had all these other things that were already written into the original script and the second script. I mean, Chuck Bogue had done a rewrite. He wasn't even there. I don't know who did the draft before him. But I just got kind of saddled with a lot that was already there and trying to fit my story into that stuff. And that's how I ended up with, like, sole credit, you know, on IMDb, and I didn't really even want that, but I called Chuck, and he said, no, that's okay, but mine was a mess, I had nothing to do with it, I kind of dropped out of it after a while, and I said, because Bill Bauer, he got screwed over by me on Wild West, they gave me sole credit, and I told the producer, you can't do that, it's got to be arbitrated by the Writers Guild, so they went back and gave him credit on the Wild Wild West, because I was just brought in to rewrite him, and, you know, I said, there's a process you got to go through, and I don't deserve sole credit. It wasn't my story. I just tried to fix it and make it work for producers.
And by some weird twist of fate, Elmer Bernstein actually would go on to score the film version of The Wild Wild West.
Yeah, I think he had some relationship with one of the producers knew him. I don't know if it was Kurtz or if it was the Brownstein, that was Lansky guy.
Yeah.
Might have been him. Because he's a great composer, and how they got him, that was like a real feather in their cap. I said, geez, Elmer Bernstein, he did To Kill a Mockingbird, one of my favorite soundtracks. You know,
that guy is incredible,
you know. But, yeah, and they were interesting guys. But Lansky was a giant. He looked like that Andre the Giant. He was like 6'8", and weighed about 300-something pounds. The sweetest man you'll ever meet. He had a heart of gold. I remember when they went in the first meeting with the producers, he sat on a chair and broke it. He fell through to the floor. He was so big, you know. And his partner, Bill Brownstein, was a little scrappy guy who was, you know, just, you know, the real money guy and trying to, like, get some more violence in there. We got to have some more action, get some more sex, you know. And Arthur was just this, like I say, a gentle giant, sweet guy. And then they were up against the Greens and then Gary Kurtz. And the Greens were putting out, they were the distributors for Europe, so they had a lot to say. And Kurtz was, I don't know how he came aboard. I don't know if originally he was the original guy. I guess he was, but he was the one who hired Lisberger. And like I could tell, he kind of thought after a while that I just didn't give a damn. And it was more that I was frustrated. You know, I kept saying, you know, I really, you know, think that you have to have a vision here. It starts with the director, and I'll do whatever the vision is, but I need to know. And Steve seems to have all these philosophical things that are interesting, but that's not a movie, you know. I still don't know what the movie is, and it was just, it was heartbreaking because it was tough. I mean, I fought, and then finally I asked out. I said, look, my mother had cancer at the time, and I said, you know, I need to get back to the States. I don't, I, you know, I don't want to miss if my mother passes and I'm not there, but I you know, you guys told me this would be a 3-week gig and I've been here 4 months, so
yeah,
like I was, you know, so I finally they let me go. Being released.
It's a fascinating story. I always love to to hear this stuff, because it's for some of these older films it's not really explored, because of the way a film's life is basically determined by its box office, and
I still have the original DVDs for this. I don't even know if it's on CD, Blu-ray, or any of those. I don't know if it ever went to that. Probably not. Like I said, Moonstone was the last company that owned it, but I have the old DVDs. You know, you put in a DVD player. They gave me I didn't even get a poster. I mean, Gary Chris never even bothered to send me. I wanted a poster because I liked the poster. I thought,
yeah,
it was a cool poster.
The poster sort of belies the film in a lot of senses. Looks, I mean, because it looks very science fiction-y, action-y.
Right, and then again, that's what I really thought we were going to do. And when I first got it, I was really excited. I said to a bunch of people, you know, I've never written anything like this, but this is kind of my first sci-fi thing. But it's grounded in a real, like I said, last detail on the future. It's an action piece, a guy taking a prisoner up river, being pursued by a bounty hunter, but in this slipstream, this weird space where all these flying out, and that's what I thought it was going to be, you know, the whole movie. And then it just got, you know, it kept getting grounded by all these other intellectual things that they wanted in it. And it's too bad, because I think it could have been really interesting, you know. It had such good visual locales.
Yeah. Well, Tony, you know what you need to do, mate? In this current Hollywood climate, you need to bring it out, dust it off, get it to Dwayne Johnson, and reboot the thing.
Right now, I'm kind of working without an agent. I dumped my last day. I have an attorney. But if I get one of my two projects going, like the Jamaican thing, which we're getting close. We had 50 Cent attached about 2 months ago, and that fell apart. But if I can get something going, then I might go back to UTA with my old agent. He's a partner now, Jeremy Zimmer, and try and resurrect something like this. Because I have another piece, too. I love the Ron Howard piece, and there was a guy who he's the one who knocked up Elizabeth Hurley. I forget his name. He's a realtor or something. And he read the script and he loved it. And he had a deal with Warners. And I said, can't you get Warners to give you that script? He said, no, they won't put it in turnaround. I said, but you're there. Plus, I used all the movie music from Dire Straits' Brothers in Arms for that movie that I did for Ron. And Ron had never heard of the Dire Straits soundtrack. When he listened to it, he went, oh, my God, it's like they wrote the soundtrack for your film. I said, no, I wrote the film for that soundtrack.
Wow.
I heard it and I thought, and I said, it's so perfect for our movie, but we never got it going. And that's another movie I'd love to see made, because it's a coming of age thing. And one kid wants to be Rambo, and it's about a guy who controls all these islanders that run a uranium mine, and he needs these mercenaries to keep him in line. And these two kids end up getting drunk, and they think they're joining the Merchant Marine, and they end up on an island in the South Equatorial Chain with some mercenaries. And one kid is in the fortress, and the other kid joins the natives and helps them get the island back. And, you know, it's about two kids that become men and heroes and, you know, grow up at the same time. And it was a great little story, but never got it made. And it's frustrating, because it's one of my better efforts.
So. Well, I think that the environment is right, because, you know, I think that the last detail set against the backdrop of a post-apocalyptic society where the earth is ravaged by a river of wind, I think, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's so timely. I mean, with climate change and everything else. And Trump threatening to nuke the world.
Like I said, we just need the Rock in it, and we'll be fine.
Yeah, hey, I don't even know how.
That's a green light right there.
I hope I gave you some insight. I wish there was something else I could.
No, that's fantastic. Plus the other stories. I think the time is right. You need to sit down and write the book. You know, your adventures in the screen trade.
Do a
William Goldman. Sit down and because you played cards with Peter O'Toole and Kirk Douglas threw a script at you, and wow, you know.
Yeah, I've had some interesting experiences. I've spoken at a couple colleges. I taught a class for young gang members at USC. They were all these kids from South Central, and they were really bright. It was amazing. And someone said, because they wanted to learn screenwriting. And they said, well, what script do you want to give? And now I picked the script of, everyone said, they'll never like that. They won't get it. I picked The Verdict by David Mamet because it's a perfect screenplay in the sense of all the right beats that it hits as far as character beats. And I wanted them to understand that the character is the most important thing. You got to hit these certain things. Otherwise, you don't care about anybody in the movie. And it set it up, and they all got it. When I finished the class after 12 weeks, these kids were amazing. A couple of them wrote scripts, and one of them was about a black hockey player. I gave it to my agent, and my agent didn't know what to do with it. I said, come on, man, this is great. You know, we tried to get it out there, but I saw that they, you know, screenwriting is an art, and you got to understand it. And, you know, man, it was great. That script, it was just so perfectly done. And that's where I, you know, Charlotte Rampling was in that movie. So I had a little connection there.
But I mean, that's something that you just mentioned there that is missing, I think, from the modern movie. Is you said, you know, it's all about character. If you don't care about the characters, you're not going to be...
Yeah, you don't care. I didn't see Wonder Woman. Everyone's saying how great it is. Okay?
Yeah.
My problem is I'm so burned out on superheroes because every movie is CGI and effects and people flying and crazy stunts. And I get lost in the production value and not the story. You know, I know that some of them have had stories, but yeah, when they bring in a really great writer like Arthur Lorenz for Spider-Man or to help give it some character, I understand. But the old movies, if you don't care about the main character, he doesn't have an arc, he could be the biggest son of a bitch in the world, but by the end, there's got to be something about him that, you know, you like, that he did something and you go, oh yeah, the guy saw the light, you know. And that's what makes good movies. I mean, and there's so many great movies in the 70s and early 80s with great characters.
Yeah.
And you don't see hardly any of those anymore. They're all kind of, I don't know, you know, it's a lost art. And, you know, I got to meet Robert Altman. He was so great. And he talked about my script and told me why I loved it. And I was really touched by it. Cause but then I said, I haven't had a great success, you know, like a lot of other writers. But I look at some of the films today, and I just think, you know, I love, like, one of my favorite little films was with the guy who just did Three Billboards. I loved In Bruges. I love that movie.
Oh, yes, like, yes. I love that movie. It's a great film.
Yeah, I just thought it was one of the best movies. Ralph Fiennes was the most incredible character, and I love Gleason, Brendan Gleason, and what's his name? I never was a big fan of the other guy, and I loved him in that. I thought he was terrific. Colin, I thought, what a great film that was. It was quirky, but it was, you liked it, the characters were so good, and you just don't see movies like that.
And like you brought up before, Ben Kingsley's film, The Sexy Beast, was a good movie as well.
Oh, brilliant. And that cast, you got Ray Winston, you got Ian McShane, I mean, those guys were brilliant in that. I mean, it was just such a good movie, and I know, and there's a lot of American films that were like that, little films that people, like Point Blank, and movies that I used to go see that just had such great character stuff in it. You know, you couldn't wait. I mean, they're just so well done. And now they're few and far between, but there are a lot more independent films that are good. Smaller films that are coming out now that, you know, you go see and you think, yeah, you know. I mean, I just saw Three Billboards. It was interesting to me. I liked it. It kind of had a weird ending, and I liked the ending, but there's spots in the middle. I thought, wow, why'd they put that guy in there? But it was, I liked the acting. I thought, God, I love Woody Harrelson. I thought Rockwell was great. And, I did a movie about drone pilots a year ago that we almost had set up, and I wanted Sam Rockwell, and they said he isn't big enough. I thought he'd be perfect for Dewey, this character, and then I wanted Woody for it, and we didn't get it going. Then they tried to do it as a pilot, a TV pilot, and I hated that. I wrote it as a pilot, but it was frustrating because it was all about the drone war and how, you know, it's kind of like A Few Good Men at the end. The guy just explodes, stands up, and tells off all his superiors.
They just can't handle the truth.
It's really hard to get people to make those kind of movies, though. The money's not there. You know, I just met a guy in Park City. My daughter's a ballerina, and he was interested in reading two of my scripts, and I didn't know why. And they said, how much would it cost to make this? So I thought, hey, maybe this guy, you know. So I told him. He said, that's interesting. So I sent him the two scripts. We'll see. You know, I'm hoping he might want to do the one in New Orleans, because I wanted Harry Connick and Rooney Mara in that, and we can do it for about $8 million, and this woman can get two or three. Maybe he can come up. He's a very successful, he has his own real estate company in Arizona, and he does mining, and you know, okay. And you never know. You meet these characters that want to get in the film business, and and they'll put up some money, you know. But yeah, that's how things have to get done today. It's sad. The studios aren't going to make any of it.
No, it's true. Well, Tony, it's been ripper talking to you, mate, and I'll...
I hope you can use this in the podcast. It's fantastic.
There was lots of revelations that cleared a lot of things up. Yeah.
Good. Okay.
Yeah. But
all right, man.